I would like to welcome everybody to Parshat Shalach, 5769. Those of you who would like to follow 798, it's very hard to follow me when I read from the Chumash because I rarely do. this Parsha is rather well known. The main episode of Shalach is the spies touring the land of Israel. There are 12 of them. 10 of them come back with a disparaging report, and apparently that influences the masses of Israel to become afraid. And 2 of them, Yehoshua and Kalev, remain steadfast in their faith, and they try to refute the negative report, but apparently they were outnumbered, and their encouragement did not keep the people strong. So I'm not going to go through all the details of the story because I trust that most of you are familiar with it. I would like to address a certain aspect of it, but first let me also welcome our new virtue as we continue our path through Mesilas Yesharim. And last week and a couple weeks before, we were discussing Tahara, purity, which is purity of thought and motive, intent. And according to our 40-day calendar, we have just begun the virtue of Chassidus, of piety. It begins with chapter 18 in the book. We have discussed piety on numerous occasions before, but now we are set to focus on it for 40 days, today being day number 2. And Chassidus is more than just one of the attributes. It was also the term used for 2 major divisions, if you will, of the path. That although there were 10 virtues, Rabbi Luzzatto states that the 10 can be reduced into really 2 subsets. One is righteousness or tzidkus, a person being a tzaddik if he has reached that level. That's the first half of the path, and the second half of the path referred to as chassidus, piety. The very, very basic definition of those two terms is that a tzaddik, a righteous person, does what he is supposed to do, and a chassid, a pious person, does more than he is supposed to do. So when we are studying now the virtue of piety, we're getting really into the specific areas of actualizing that state of being, where a person is moved and animated and driven to serve God even more than what he is obligated to do. And that obviously is very intriguing. You know, there's plenty that we have to do. Why would a person seek to do more? And we've discussed that on numerous occasions, but God willing, this time we're going to be spending more time on it. And I would like to specifically relate our induction into the virtue of piety to what's going on in the Parsha. Those of you who were here last week, I know some of you were not, but we really shared some comments from a great rabbi of the 1800s, the Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was one of the heads of the first modern yeshiva. I say a modern yeshiva because really the idea of having a regional Torah center did not start until the early 1800s. It was an idea that was promoted by the Vilna Gaon. In his time, they didn't exist such a yeshiva, but he inspired his student to go on and found such a yeshiva. And the Netziv, Rabbi Berlin, was one of the subsequent heads of that yeshiva. What he said, really, in his introduction to the book of Bamidbar, encompasses Bahalotcha and Shalach. And this is what we shared last week. I'll just do a very brief review of that. we saw that there was a transition between the Jewish life in the desert and the Jewish life in the land of Israel. And it was intended to be two different lifestyles. When the Jews were in the desert, and they were for the longest time encamped around the mountain of Sinai, there was what's called the Hanhaga Nisis, the miraculous existence. Miraculous in the sense that God manifested himself openly, revealingly. There was no doubt whatsoever that the people, in the people's minds, that they were living literally enveloped in the embrace of God. They had many, many signs to attest to that. Their whole daily existence was evidence of that. The clouds of glory, the manna, the water, the Sinai experience, everything. They had no question, there were no doubts, there were no questions. But what they learned, and this is what kind of prompted the transition, is that what they learned is that if you make a mistake when you're in God's direct presence, the consequences are fatal. And we saw in last week's Parsha some examples of this. We saw how there was some complaining, and there was an outbreak of fire that consumed people. There was complaining about lack of meat. There was the immediate response was quail, and that caused the demise of many of the people. There was the incident of Lashon Hara, of the ill speech, slightly ill, which Miriam spoke and Aaron spoke of Moshe, and there was an immediate and severe response. So around that time, the people started getting a little bit uncomfortable with the Anhaga Nisis, with this miraculous existence. True, it's nice to know that God is there, but with him so close, it makes life a little bit too close for comfort. And so what happens in Parsha Shlach, says the Netziv, who reveals to us, is that the people start campaigning on their own volition to move into the next phase prematurely. If we could say God's intent was that they would eventually enter the land of Israel, still under the Hanhaga Nisis, still under the miraculous way, and gradually, after they would conquer the land, gradually they would transition into the more natural approach, which would mean God would be less manifest, things would be more natural. There would be, you know, no clouds, no manna, no water. Everyone would work their own field and grow their own crops. People wouldn't be surrounded by the clouds. Yes, there would be a tabernacle in the middle where we could come to periodically, but by and large, it would be more natural. And God would, of course, still be there, but he would be more hidden. Eventually, that would have happened anyway. But the people were pushing for it to happen sooner. And that's the whole, that's the background, says the Netziv, that's the whole context within which the Parsha of Shalach opens up. You know, and you have to just, let me just have to review one, just a matter of factual reporting. The Parsha opens up that Hashem told Moshe, send the spies. Okay, we have to understand that that's not how the story went exactly. Rashi immediately calls to our attention the Parsha of Devarim, where the Moshe is recounting 40 years later, recounting the incident of the spies, and it's quite clear that Moshe says, what happened was that you, the people, came to me and said, let us send spies. You told us. I'll read to you exactly how it worked. The wording of the Parsha and Devarim. Page 945, verse 22 in chapter 1. All of you approached me and said, let us send men ahead of us and let them spy out the land and bring word back to us, the road on which we should ascend and the cities to which we should come. You approached me. You said, let us send spies. Says the Netziv, that wasn't the plan. That wasn't the plan originally. We were going to go into the land of Israel just like we traveled through the desert to the mountain of Sinai. The clouds of glory would have been around us. God would have taken us in with his manifest glory, and he would have cleared the path of all enemies, people that would stop us. But you said no. You said, enough with the clouds, enough with the miraculous existence. Let's start the natural approach now. Let's go in like any normal nation would take a land. Let's send spies. Let's develop a strategy. And that's where the Parsha Shlach enters, kind of mid-scene. Rashi says that Moshe went to Hashem and said, should I acquiesce to their request? And Hashem said, that's up to you, Moshe. You're the boss. You decide if they do send spies or not. I'm not going to tell them to, because I'm afraid that if they are looking to get away from my miraculous leadership, I'm afraid that they're looking at their, well, I'm afraid, we're going to talk about this, what happened to them. I'm afraid of what's going to happen. So I'm not going to tell them to send spies. But if you think that that's what they need to do because that's what they're clamoring for, you make that decision. And that's where it says, Hashem said to Moshe, Shlach lecha anashim, send forth men if you please. We have to know that the way that the story happened is not just at the way it's written here. This narrative is not complete. So the Netziv says this is an incredibly, incredibly significant change. It's a new course of action. The people were looking to escape from the anhaganesis, from the miraculous existence they had until now. Now, based on that whole introduction, there's something that seems to me very, very peculiar and very perplexing. So what happened? On Monday morning, let's look back at the game and let's analyze. Hashem was going to bring them in and there would have been no struggles. They said, no, God, to quote my 3-year-old son, I want to do it myself. I want to do it myself. So God says, all right. I'm not going to suggest it, but if that's what you're asking, you know, let your father decide. Moshe says, okay. So they go in, they're going to do it themselves, right? Big, strong, independent. They go in, what do they see? Oy, giants! The land is burying its inhabitants. There's no way we could possibly conquer it. They come back home, come back to the people, they say, we can't do it. And everyone says, oy vey, and they cry. And isn't that strange? If they're so macho, why did they come back so afraid? It's ironic. They could have had it so easy. They could have let God take them in. There wouldn't have been a struggle. But they insisted on going themselves until they realized that they can't, and then they panicked. And that was the end. And it was a tragic end. They didn't get to go in forever. Only the next generation would go in. Tragedy. What in the world got into them? But we know it's always like that. It's always like that, isn't it? The child, the 2-year-old, I want to do it myself. But you can't do it yourself. I want to do it myself. And what happens? They do it themselves. They fall down. They start crying, "Mommy, Mommy, help me." Isn't that how it happens? We want to be independent, and then we realize we can't do it. Look at a teenager. The teenager doesn't want to dad and mom telling him what to do all the time. They want to be on their own. So what do? They move out on their own, and then they say, "Dad, I can't afford an apartment. Can you lend me the money? Dad, I don't have a car. Can I borrow your car?" But if you would have just been at my house, if you would have just stayed here, you would have had free room, free board. You can use my car whenever you want. But you wanted to get out from under our noses, but you realize you can't do it yourself. So you come running back home. Isn't that how independence always works? And what was the secret of Kalev and Yehoshua? They came back and they said to the people, "My goodness, what a different response. Kalev silenced, page 803, Kalev silenced the people toward Moses and said, "We shall surely ascend and conquer it, for we can surely do it." And there's another beautiful, beautiful phrase. I remember if it's before or after. But they say, "Tova ha'aretz me'od me'od." The land is very, very good. Wow. Talk about different interpretations. 10 people say it's terrible. 2 people say it's fantastic. What's going on here? What's going on here, I believe, is the dynamic that we have spoken about for the last several weeks. Nes and Teva, miracle and nature, is very much linked to the terms that we learned about before Shavuos from Rav Huttner, and we reviewed it last week, Hechrech and Bechira. Necessity, you must do, and it's your choice. Those two are very, very related, interrelated. See, in life, you can't have your cake and eat it too. Go back to the teenager. If you want daddy and mommy's protection, you also have to live in their house and listen to what they say. If you want to be on your own, you're not going to have their protection. You can't have your cake and eat it too. And the same thing is true with God. If you want God to protect you and leave a care, you know, not a care in the world, no fear, He's going to hover over you. But when He hovers over you, things are going to be so clear that you're going to have no choice but to listen to what He says. And if you don't listen, immediate consequence. You don't like having to listen to what He says. You don't like that pressure of hechrich. Fine. You could choose to be more in, for Him to recede, for Him to hide Himself, leaving you with the sense of freedom. But then He's not going to be around you to protect you. You can't have it both ways. I'm saying it very, very, like it's night and day. It's not all that simple, but I'm just trying to make the point, the conceptual point. But there's a third alternative. The third alternative, and this we've also been speaking about, is when a person, on his own, says, "When I have Bechira, when I have my free choice, when I have my independence and my freedom, I choose to accept God. I choose to accept God." And then, He will make Himself known to me. Even though He's not out there revealed, but He will come, He will be there for me. because I have accepted, I have welcomed him in, I have embraced him, therefore he will embrace me. This is what the secret of Kalev and Yehoshua. If I could, before I speak that out, if I could just summarize for a minute here. I'd like to suggest that there are four stages in this continuum of man's relationship with God. The first stage is when God reveals himself as he did in Sinai. He says, I'm here whether you like it or not. This is what I will do for you. This is what I require from you. No choice. The pressure's on. That's one stage. It's good to be in that stage for a while because we come to learn who God is. But nobody can stay there forever. After a while, you have to move on. Because we are created with the ability to be somewhat independent, somewhat God-like, if you will. To have our own autonomy, in a sense. So then, we're given a little more freedom. Now, there's two ways to go within the freedom. And I'll call it stage two and stage three. Stage two, the person is enthralled with his freedom, but hasn't sufficiently absorbed the reality of God's existence. He didn't, when it was stage one, he didn't take such good notes. And so it's not crystal clear to him who God is, where God is, what it means to have a relationship with him. So he gets out into the world of Bechira, and he kind of fumbles around. Sometimes he chooses the right way, sometimes he chooses the wrong way, and by and large, he doesn't see Hashem's there at his right side all the time. He'll get into trouble. Things will happen because it's natural. And he'll say, where was God? And God will say, well, I was hiding. Well, why didn't you come to my aid? Well, why didn't you choose me? It's a mirror image. That's stage two. A person has Bechira, but he doesn't always choose the right thing. Stage three. And literally, a person can grow in this area. Stage three is where a person says, sure, I have Bechira, but I also have clarity to know what's the right thing to choose. It's like the verse we quoted last week, Uvocharta Bechayim. Sure, you have a choice, but choose life. A person who's at that stage is in a wonderful, wonderful position. He has the best of both worlds. He has the freedom and the power and the satisfaction of being able to think and being able to choose. But he knows what to choose. And he chooses God. And because he chooses God, he always finds that God is there. So he can approach a situation which by nature it seems impossible for a human being to survive. But that doesn't faze him. Because he knows that God is there. Because he has chosen God in his life. That's what Yeshua and Kalev were. They went to Eretz Yisrael, and of course there were giants, and of course it was difficult, and of course it was impossible. But they had chosen God. And even when they were going to move into the natural environment, they were still going to choose God. And therefore they knew that God was going to make it possible. When they said, when they came back and they said, we can surely ascend and conquer it, for we can surely do it, they weren't any more macho than the other tribe, the other spies. It's not that they had greater military ability than the others. It truly was impossible without God's help. But they were confident that God would help them. That's what they meant when they said, we can surely do it. The other people looked at it and saw only the natural. And they said, we can't do it. And they apparently hadn't grabbed on to the idea of we choose God and therefore we're confident in God's salvation. There's a fourth stage, which is really not for this life. It's maybe for the messianic age. But it could happen in a person's life too, where the person becomes so clear after making choices time after time, choosing God, then it becomes once again as though he were at the mountain of Sinai again. But he came to that on his own through the process of choice after choice. So that's my humble analysis of the Parsha. And I believe that this is something which is not just historical, but this is truly a portrait of the Jews' life with God in the world. We have the masses of the people, when given a little bit of room, when finally leaving the cocoon and finally leaving the clouds of glory, they enjoy the freedom, they want the freedom, they crave the freedom, but somehow they don't quite have the clarity of making the right choices. And therefore they also lack the confidence of God's protection. And then we have a few, Yehoshua and Kalev representing the few, that have that confidence, have that clarity, and even when they're given the freedom of choice, they choose God. And they get the benefit of God's intervention. Okay, let me stop here for a minute. I know we have a couple of comments, and then we're going to bring it back to the Mesilas Yesharim, God willing.
One question.
Yeah.
I guess the comment is, I'm trying to figure out, I had the impression that the spies were really guilty of acting independently prematurely.
Yes.
But if they had come back and told the truth and not lied, what then? Is the question number one. Number two...
They didn't lie.
Well, I thought the traditional analysis is that they didn't lie when they came back.
No.
I don't believe so. They said the people are giants. This is the fruit. The fruit was indeed giant.
Okay.
Well, I don't think they lied. I think they were telling the truth.
But the sinful act or the guilty act was going on the... was being a spy to begin with. Because they lacked faith in God and they acted independently prematurely. But I would hasten to point out that Yeshua and Saleb were part of that group.
Well, once Moshe was sending the spies, he made sure to send some that would come back with a counter-argument so that the people could hear that there was an alternative. There's always a balance between good and evil. So if all there is a unanimous voice that it's impossible and nobody's saying anything otherwise, then there's no choice for the Jewish people. They had to have that choice. Linda and then Victor.
Is it conceivable that if Hashem had sent them in his way to the land, that they also then would have chosen spies? In other words, they're proceeding to the land and then they decide to have spies.
Right.
What would have been the...
Again, the original plan was they would not have gone in under the natural approach. They would have gone in under the miraculous approach. And the natural approach would have only kicked in after they had conquered and settled the land. That's what it would have happened.
So that they would have felt no need.
That's right. And the amazing thing is that Kalev and Yehoshua, even though they saw the nature, they still had, and they were in the mode of bechira, of choice, they still chose the path of confidence in God. Yes?
Yeah, I didn't just rebuttal here. Surely all 12 spies saw the same thing.
Yes.
How so was it Kalev and Yehoshua different? And I might suggest that they all saw with their eye, but Kalev and Yehoshua saw with their heart also.
Beautiful.
The fact that Kalev went to Hebron,
mm-hmm.
and he saw the graves of Abraham, Isaac, etc., gives him a remembrance of things past.
Beautiful.
Whereas the other guys are just seeing what they see. They don't even remember the past. But if you remember the past, mm-hmm. then you're able to act for the future. in a way.
So you're saying that the knowledge of the past is a great source of our faith.
Well, and that's exactly why you have tzitzit, say.
Tzitzit.
To look at them.
How about
remember,
Pesach?
Remember, and then you can do.
Yeah, very good.
So that, and it's also in this parsha for the same reason.
Oh, look, I forgot about
remember
that.
Remember and
wonderful.
Do. Whereas the other people, they just see. They look at the physical world, and
very
they don't
good.
Think about it spiritually.
Nice.
Remember when I've gotten the thought, which I've had for a number of years now, that they lied? Somebody must have. I read.
You may have read that. Does anybody know?
Many people have heard people say, especially like when you're just kind of going with, let's say that the spies told Lashon Hara about the land. A lot of people think that means they automatically. They didn't lie.
Yeah.
They just had a bad attitude about what they saw. They told. They
speaking
told
negatively.
The actual truth.
Yeah.
They said these people live here. These people live here. But they were saying that like, oh man. These people live here.
They
and
were
these
being
people
dramatic
live here. And these people live here. How are we ever going to get in?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just factually.
They were exaggerating.
They're here, they're here, they're here,
well,
but no problem.
Half empty for them.
Yeah, very
right.
Half full for us.
We have to move on, but all right, let's see if we can take the comments. I promise I will come back to you. Wendy, you'll be number one. Before we move on to the Nesilas Yesharim, I would just like to, if I could postulate, I know that Eretz Yisrael is at the front and center of all of our minds, all the time. And Baruch Hashem, we have in the last 60 years, a whole revival and renaissance of Jewish life in Eretz Yisrael. It's just incredible. May we postulate the following about the nature of Eretz Yisrael? Eretz Yisrael is a land which is engineered for people like Yehoshua and Kalev.
Mm.
If you go to Eretz Yisrael with natural eyes or with just eyes, you're bound to see a difficult land in every way.
Nowadays?
Difficult.
Are you talking now?
Nowadays, then-a-days. It's a difficult land. Ask Israelis. A lot of people leave Israel, unfortunately, because it's a land that was engineered and designed to live along with choosing God. It's the holy land. For a person who comes to the land without the clarity that Hashem is here, they're going to see difficulties. They're going to see problems. A person who enters the land with the attitude of Ubacharta v'chayim, we have freedom, but we know to choose life, to choose God, then it is the most beautiful place to be.
So true.
Tova ha'aretz me'od me'od. The land is exceedingly beautiful. How come not everybody says that? Because not everybody is Uvacharta b'chayim. Not everybody is living the choice of life. They're coming in expecting it to be just a normal land. You see, other lands in the world, I don't think are necessarily wired that way. You can live in another country, and God doesn't pretend to invite people in that land to live in a harmonious relationship with Him. Therefore, He hides himself so much that you can do whatever you want and still have everything. You can enjoy life in France or in South Africa or in the United States. It's not intended to be a land where you have to choose God in order to see its greatness. Eretz Yisrael is. And therefore, a person who goes to Eretz Yisrael must study this parsha very well to know how to enter and how to look. If you look at Eretz Yisrael like the 10 spies, expecting just nature to be there, without any expectation of living a godly life, of choosing life, of choosing God, you're not going to find beauty. If you go there with the recognition that you're expected there to be, to choose God and choose life, it's the best place in the world. So I would just like to make that passing comment, and With that, bring this back to the Mesilas Hasharim, and then we'll take comments. We noted that, as we see from the Parsha, only 2 out of 12 had the right perspective, had the desirable perspective. How does a person have the right perspective? What is it? These were all great men. These were all tzaddikim, as the Torah says in the beginning. Kulam anashim, they were all distinguished men. Rashei b'nei Yisrael hema, heads of the children of Israel were they. All of them. These were the best. Why did 10 of them come back disheartened and 2 of them came back still positive? It reminds me of what Rabbi Luzzatto says about the 2 divisions of the path that we spoke about earlier. When he begins after Nikius, after the attribute of cleanliness, and he starts the virtue of precious of abstinence, he says, and we read this before, abstinence is the first step towards piety, Hasidus. And here I want to point out that whatever we have explained until now referred to what a person had to do in order to become righteous, tzaddik. From here onward, the subject is how one can become pious. And later he says, sorry that I didn't get the page, he says, you'll remember, hopefully you'll remember, not everyone can be pious. Not everyone can be pious. Piety is for the few. We talked about this. We had a class about this. How do you know if you're material of piety or not? Remember, if you have abundance mentality a few weeks ago? That's the difference between tzidkus and chassidus. Tzidkus is a person who's in the second stage, and chassidus is the person who's on the third stage. Your standard person who's on the second stage, he says, yeah, I know that we have to do things for God. I know we have responsibilities. I am very pleased with the bechira that I have. I've been given some freedom. I don't have total clarity. I know we've got to do it. So, I guess I'll do what I have to do. And then I'll try to get as much out of life as I can on my terms, but I'll still fulfill my obligations. There's always going to be a struggle. Did I fulfill it properly? Did I not fulfill it? Did I do enough? Was I careful enough? And you know, at the end of the day, halavai that this person will live up to the obligations, but never more. A tzaddik he'll be, but not a chassid. But take a person who's like Kalev and Yehoshua. Take a person who, when given the freedom, knows what to choose, has total clarity. Choosing God and choosing to serve Him, this person is not going to be a tzaddik. This person is going to be a chassid. This person is going, as Rabbi Luzzatto defines for us, piety. Like a son to a father. If a father were to just barely express his desire for something on page 114, the son will still do everything within his power to satisfy this wish. Even if the father expressed himself only once, even in a half a sentence, the son would have no difficulty in understanding his father's desire, including the unstated parts. For through his own reasoning, he understands this pleases his father. He need not wait until his father instructs him more explicitly or repeats his words. A chassid is a person who has chosen to be a son to God. And therefore, he doesn't read the fine print and say, what do I have to do? He has a total different orientation. This is my choice. This is what I know to be the true raison d'etre. What can I do? What would God like? I'll do more. I'll do as much as I possibly can. What will I do for others? I'll do as much as I can. We're talking about one person who's in the second stage. He's a tzaddik. The person in his third stage, he's a chassid. And that's why, and the Rabbi Lefater says, you're only going to have a small percentage of people among Israel who are going to be chassidim. Just like we only had 2 out of 12. I don't know if that's the ratio, but it fits. The average Jew struggles with his relationship with God. The average Jew knows that there are duties, knows that there are obligations, but also enjoys his freedom. The unique Jew, like Kolev or like Yeshua, doesn't have a struggle because his desires are to do the will of God, and therefore he has no lack of creative ways to please God in many ways beyond what is obligated. And just to close it off, a person might conclude that it's a little bit discouraging because, after all, what chance do I have to be one of those select few? But I tell you, from the fact, I've got two proofs that we can feel greatly encouraged, each and every one of us. Number one, that only less than, you know, a couple of hundred years ago, this Sefer came out and was publicized. And today it is in the domain of every single Jew, whether he knows Hebrew or not. God, in his ways of working, is telling us that we can all, we have earned, through the long exile that we have been, we have earned the right to read the manual for Hasidim. Every single one of us. There's not this book is so well publicized. Rabbi Twersky has his commentary. We can all aspire to Hasidus. And number two, Eretz Yisrael. It is the domain of every single Jew today. For thousands of 2,000 years, we couldn't go to the land. We were like that generation that had to sit in the desert because you guys just don't get it. You don't have the concept of getting freedom and choosing God. You have to stay in the desert. After 2,000 years, we're all brought into the land. Realize what a compliment that is from God. So let's study well what the Torah is, the lessons of the Torah, what Eretz Yisrael is, how Eretz Yisrael is not just a land, it is that place on earth which is designed to be entered with the recognition of Uvocharta b'chayim, choose life. We have clarity. We know that God is there and can be manifest as strongly as is necessary. And when he hides himself, it's only because he's giving us the trust and the opportunity to choose him, even when he's hidden. And the place to do that is in Eretz Yisrael. But don't make the mistake of thinking of Eretz Yisrael as just like a regular place, because then you're going to see the problems. Eretz Yisrael is a place which, if you understand that it's the land of God, it will be beautiful. You don't have to worry. You don't have that clarity. It's going to be a place fraught with problems. That is what I had to say. Yashar Koach, thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.